Case number 21-7109 et al. National ATM Council, Inc. et al. Versus Visa, Inc. et al. Appellants. Mr. Anderson for the MasterCard and Visa Appellants. General issues and issues specific to the consumer classes. Mr. Eisenstein for the MasterCard and Visa Appellants. Issues specific to the ATM operator class. Mr. Rubin for the ATM operator appellees. Mr. Cooper for the Mattman appellees. Mr. Lobel for the Burt appellees.
Good morning, Mr. Anderson.
Good morning, Judge. May it please the court. My name is Justin Anderson. I represent MasterCard in this appeal from the erroneous certification of three classes challenging non-discrimination rules applicable to surcharges at ATM. I will address the two consumer classes and arguments that pertain to all three classes. My colleague, Matthew Eisenstein, who represents Visa, will address issues specific to the class of independent ATM operators. Your Honors, the class certification in these cases violates settled circuit precedent and must be reversed. In Rail Freight, this court held that Rule 23 commands a hard look at injury models plaintiffs put forward in the district court to satisfy their burden of proving predominance. That hard look did not happen here. In the district court, MasterCard and Visa showed that each plaintiff's model of injury contained false positives. They swept in class members who could not have been injured. But the district court did not scrutinize the evidence that we presented. The court considered uninjured class members to be irrelevant to the question of class certification and deferred the issue to the merits phase of the case. It held that plaintiffs had a burden to only show a reasonable or colorable model of injury. That was error. The district court's analysis is directly contrary to Rail Freight, which instructs that it is, quote, indisputably the role of the district court to scrutinize evidence before granting certification, even when doing so requires inquiry into the merits of the claim, end quote. Whether the injury model can establish class-wide injury and withstand that level of scrutiny is not just a merits question. It is a question for class certification.
But why shouldn't we understand on review for abuse of discretion that what the district court said was, I see general claims on the plaintiff's part that every class member was injured, and I see evidence sufficient to support that. I see defendants countering with a different way of analyzing the evidence that, by the way, is also a wholesale, you know, approach to a subset of the class. I'm satisfied that that is a situation in which common issues predominate, and I'll make the final call, or the jury will make the final call, as to which analysis ultimately on the merits they accept. But isn't the predominance inquiry a filter that's supposed to look at, are these wholesale questions?
That's exactly.
Or are these case by case questions? And I don't actually see evidence in this record that's not wholesale.
Your Honor, that's exactly the right question that the district court should have answered. It should have asked that question and addressed the question. Instead, it held the plaintiffs to the burden only of showing a model that was colorable or well accepted. What the district court should have answered is this question. Is there common evidence that in one fell swoop can show that all members of the class were injured? That question, Your Honor, cannot be satisfied by the models here. Now, the district court did not scrutinize the evidence that we put forward. However, we showed that using—
He said he did.
Your Honor, the district court said that he was applying a standard that held the plaintiffs to only show that the models were reasonable. He said that the Mackin class had put forward a, quote, colorable and well-accepted methodology. That the Burr class had put forward a well-accepted methodology, and this was not an adjudication on the merits. He said that the independent ATM operators put forward both a colorful methodology and it referred to our contesting of the merits as a question for the merits. That's directly contrary to Rail Freight, where this court said that plausible is not enough, but workable is not enough. The district court needs to take a hard look at the models that are put forward and determine whether they can identify injury across the class. Because if you can't show class-wide injury at class certification, we will raise this point again at summary judgment, and we will argue that there are class members who lack standing. And there are tens of thousands or more, hundreds of thousands, potentially, in light of the facts that we've put in front of the district court. The district court was required to scrutinize and grapple with that evidence. The plaintiff's theory in these cases on the consumer side is that for every 1 cent reduction in net interchange that ATM operators receive, they increase surcharges on consumers by 1 cent. It's a one-to-one relationship. It's a simple model of injury. They say every class member was injured in that fashion. But we scrutinized the evidence in the case, and we found for one of the country's largest banks that it did not raise surcharges at all during the class period and during the time frame that their expert evaluated. What that means is any class member who withdrew cash from that ATM was uninjured, and at a trial, we, MasterCard and Visa, would have the right to introduce evidence as to each class member, whether they withdrew cash from that ATM or one of thousands of other ATMs that did not increase surcharges during the class period, to show they lack injury, lack standing in this case.
What the plaintiff said in response, though, was not, oh yeah, let's do one by one trials, or nor even, oh, you're right, there are some who are uninjured. What they said was, you didn't go back, surcharges were raised earlier, and you don't account for that. And so I guess I'm, you know, and the district judge does say all three plaintiff groups have demonstrated that common evidence will predominate, proving each element of their claim. So you can pull out, you know, infelicitous comments that he makes about plausible or reasonable. I guess for me, it would be helpful to know more concretely, what standard you think does apply? You know, this has been a contested question across the circuits. And I understand that courts should make findings, but should it say, I reject your evidence and I credit the plaintiff's evidence? I took it to be more what I thought we agreed to before, which is that it should look at the character of the dispute. Is it between wholesale and wholesale, or is it something that, you know, some granularity that is inevitable?
Your Honor, this court has already spoken to that question twice in the Rail Freight cases.
Can you give me more help on that?
I can, Your Honor. In Rail Freight 1, the issue was that plaintiffs were seeking to recover damages for wholesalers who had purchased on contracts that were set before the alleged antitrust violation began. And that's what prompted that case. How could those people have been injured if they had locked in rates before the challenged activity began? And to the extent the model swept in uninjured class members, it failed the question of predominance. And that was the basis for the initial decision. That is the same issue here. How can someone who withdrew cash from an ATM that did not increase the surcharge, either in response to the reduction at interchange, or for some of them at all, argue that they've been injured? What is the basis for the injury when they did not pay the overcharge? It's the same question.
I want to be clear as to how far your argument goes. In other words, I'm clear as to your point about the district court's articulation of the legal standard he was to apply was erroneous as a matter of law. Now, you want us to reverse the district court's decision. My question is, the way your briefs, or not your briefs, but the way the arguments are made that you've presented as to, for instance, the largest ATM, maybe the class needs to be redefined in light of the appropriate standard to exclude those consumers. But it doesn't necessarily, or does it, foreclose the district court from, I'll just say in a sense, reaching the same result that a redefined class should be certified as distinct from our deciding this case can never go forward under any definition of a class. And of course, if we reversed and remand, we wouldn't be doing that. But I just want to be clear, because your argument says that, you know, your clients are presented this evidence showing there could be no injury as to a large number of potential class members. But I just want to be clear, does that mean even under the correct standard, or you're not deciding that now, but I want to be clear, when you said we should just reverse, I wondered whether that was what you were arguing. In fact, even though under abuse of discretion review, an error of law is an abuse of discretion. And so we would send it back and let, normally in cases, let the district court apply the correct standard, but we wouldn't suggest no remand, thereby suggesting that there could be no other result on remand once the district court applies the correct legal standard.
Brother, we are asking for a reversal or a remand with instructions to decertify. And we recognize that that is not the course that the court would take ordinarily. But this case presents a unique scenario where it is a question of law, but about whether the district court applied the correct standard. He did not. If you apply the correct standard here, the undisputed facts show, because plaintiff's own experts admitted that there are ATMs that did surcharges in response to the reduction in net interchange.
I'm not contesting that argument that you make. I'm just asking, could not the district court, or do you say it would be impossible for the district court, even upon applying the correct standard on remand, to offer the plaintiffs an opportunity to redefine the class and then determine on the basis of that redefined class whether or not the burden, the plaintiffs had met their burden?
It would, Your Honor. Under the applicable standard, the plaintiffs have simply not given the district court the tools it would need to approve a class that winnows out uninjured class members. And that's why we refer the court to the Third Circuit precedents in Ferraris, in Real Life USA, and the Eighth Circuit decision in Huddick. In those cases where even if you remanded to the district court, remand would be futile because there is no ability, and the plaintiffs have come forward with no proposal for how they would winnow out the class members who withdrew cash from ATMs that did not incur charges in response to reduction in
that measures. Is not the way we typically deal with legal error and factual error. I mean, the Supreme Court has told us a long time ago the district court is relying on the incorrect statement of the law. You send it back and the district court's now got to apply what we tell. Correct statement of the law, and then find the facts. I'm listening to you carefully. What you're asking us to do is make findings of fact. We have been told over and over again we don't do that.
And Your Honor, we're not asking you to make findings of fact. We are asking you to reverse on the undisputed record here. We are not contesting that plaintiff's experts in their rebuttal reports found that there were certain ATMs where there was no statistically significant relationship between the reduction of net interchange and an increase in surcharge. They admit it. There's no need for fact-finding. On their own experts' analysis, there are uninjured class members in this case. Plaintiffs have waived any rights, argue that they're entitled to show that there's a winnowing mechanism that could filter them out. Each one of them, all three sets, have doubled down in their brief saying every class member is injured. Every class member paid an inflated surcharge. They should be held to that.
I think what we're trying to get at is you're precluding the district court, and I just want to be sure you're making this argument as a matter of law, from saying to the plaintiffs, well, the models you've given me now are insufficient for many of the reasons your clients point out. I mean, their experts just hypothesize about things, et cetera. They don't point to hard data. But suppose the plaintiffs said, well, we want to redefine the class. And I don't want to go too far here, but just assume they say, well, we accept the point that the largest ATM, there's no injury as to them. But there are these other people. Now, it must be maybe a much smaller class. But your argument seems to preclude that opportunity for the plaintiffs. And I gather from what your response to me is, well, they waived any argument. And I just wondered, in other words, you're saying they'd have to start all over again and file a new complaint.
Your Honor, that's right. This case has been pending for 10 years. Rail freight was decided in 2013. This is not a new legal standard. The plaintiffs are represented by able counsel and assisted by economists whose credentials are well accepted. They had every opportunity to argue that if there were uninjured class members, they had a model for winnowing them out. We had discovery is now closed. This case the record is closed on both expert discovery and fact discovery. For them now to go back to the district court and reopen that record and propose some fashion of winnowing out uninjured class members would be an unfair burden, unfairly prejudicial to the defendants who have lived with this case for the last 10 years.
Well, you had a time limit to file your petition for review. But I initially thought, well, why didn't you file a motion for reconsideration by the district court, making the legal arguments you've made? And in that situation, hypothetically, the district court might have said, oh, yes, I'm relying on this vitamins decision, but the circuit and the Supreme Court have abandoned that colorable approach. And now the standard is different. And so I'm going to apply that standard. And so I gather part of your argument was you pointed all this out to the district court, and nevertheless, it ruled as it did, applying the vitamins colorable standard, which was no longer the standard that applied.
That's right, Your Honor. And normally, if you file a motion for reconsideration, you have to tell the judge, here's the new thing we want you to consider. And we had put all of these arguments in front of the district court in our briefing. The question of predominance, the question of uninjured class members, when it was not some side issue, this was the issue. This was the issue that we contested. There were other smaller issues, but this was the main issue that we contested class certification on with these classes. Your Honor, I had
what is the standard that you think the district court should apply?
It should take the hard look that this court said is required in Rail Freight. The Supreme Court has called it a close look in Comcast, also a, quote, rigorous analysis, end quote. That's from Comcast. And in Walmart, the Supreme Court said the court must make findings. That's a quote, even if it, again, overlaps with the merits.
How can we confidently say, reading the district court's opinion, that it didn't take a hard look, a close look, it make a rigorous analysis? And indeed, the district judge said, I find, and makes the findings.
Your Honor, if that was sufficient, this court would be deprived of appellate review in any case, because every district judge could be counted on.
We had Rail Freight. And we said, you know, there's some plaintiff acknowledges there the limitations and didn't have a comeback. And we said, okay, no class.
The Rail Freight was pre-Comcast. So the first Rail Freight decision was decided when the district court did not have the benefit of the Comcast decision. So on appeal, the panel acknowledged that the district court was applying old law. And so in that case, it cannot be the case that this court only has the ability to review district court decisions where the district court acknowledges that it is not doing what the standard requires. It can't be the
Comcast is a much clearer, different case, right? There were four different theories. The only one of them was deemed viable, but the plaintiffs or the district court continued to rely on a damages model that was predicated on all four. We just don't have something like that. The way I read Comcast and the Rail Freight decisions, they're pointing to particular kinds of errors. You know, plaintiff acknowledged that there was, you know, some 12+% of uninjured class members didn't have a comeback on that. You know, Barron's, we just talked about this. You haven't pointed that kind of defect here. It's really, you know, we have this one take on the data. They have a different take. They're saying everybody's injured. District judge isn't saying they're right, but is saying they've come forward with that. And that's standard evidence. It's evidence that could be credited, good enough.
Part of the problem is that good enough for the district court is not good enough based on the standards the Supreme Court has announced and this court has announced.
Which standard?
In Comcast and Walmart,
hard
both
look.
Rail freight decisions. The district court cannot just say good enough. It needs to take a hard look at the evidence, scrutinize evidence that's put forward by the defendants, and determine whether the models can withstand that scrutiny and show that common evidence will establish class-wide and is capable of establishing class-wide injury. That hard look did not happen here. And this court cannot defer to decisions that clearly apply the wrong standard simply because the court writes, I've considered the evidence and concluded X. That is clearly not sufficient to meet the hard look, rigorous standard that's required here. Otherwise, it would gut the standard. It would gut the precedent from this court in Ralph Wright, it would gut Comcast and Walmart, that this is not a classification, it's not a perfunctory stage similar to a motion to dismiss. This is a case, this is a stage in the case where the district court must take a hard look and resolve disputes between the parties about whether the injury model that plaintiffs put forward is capable of showing class-wide injury. Here, plaintiffs came forward and said, everyone's injured because for every 1 cent, the net differential surcharge goes up by 1 cent. We showed the district court that there are tens of thousands in the record plaintiffs swept in who withdrew cash from ATMs that never increased the surcharge in response to the decrease in net interchange. The judge needed to grapple with that. And if he had, Judge Rogers, he would have found that the evidence is indisputable. There are uninjured class members in this case. Judge, we are not asking for fact-finding. We are asking this court to apply the law to the undisputed facts in the case, which is that there are ATMs that did not increase surcharges in response to the reduction in net interchange.
Thank you. Morning, Mr. Eisenstein.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'm Matt Eisenstein. I'm going to address the independent operators case. I'm going to try to avoid repeating what Mr. Anderson said, but the district court's decision as to the independent operator case did not apply the right standard and should be vacated for the same reason as the consumer cases, because these plaintiffs do not have common proof that they can use to establish injury to all class members as they define the class, their class. These plaintiffs say that their injury is that all class members paid an inflated acquirer fee. But we know from the record that many class members did not pay those fees directly to the network or indirectly, such as by receiving a portion of interchange revenue from which acquirer fees are deducted. Here's how we know that, and the key facts here as to this case really are undisputed. These plaintiffs concede that they took the definition of an ATM operator from a Visa rule. They say that at page 9 of their brief. They say that at page 10 of the brief. They say that in footnote 5 of their brief. Visa's definition of an ATM operator is very broad. It's designed to track entities that could have access to information at independent ATMs and therefore could present fraud or other risk to the network. We know that from JA6808, which is a declaration from the head of Visa's ATM business. We know that from JA7026, which is a document adopting the Visa rule. The documents make clear that the definition that they use, the Visa definition, which is the same as their class definition, has nothing to do with which entities pay acquire fees directly or indirectly, has nothing to do with which entities manage cryptographic functions. It sweeps much broader because its purpose is to minimize risk of fraud. And the documents make clear that there's a range of entities, more than one entity per terminal, that can satisfy the definition of an ATM operator.
But the class definition is narrower. It explicitly excludes a lot of the entities that I think you say are muddying the waters, no?
That's incorrect, Your Honor, respectfully. It's the same. The definition is coextensive. They're the same. So, for example, a merchant that owns an ATM and that loads cash in the ATM. He's a class member. It's a ATM operator. We know that. There's an example at JA6078. It is a form filled out by a merchant that meets the definition of ATM operator. We know from JA6070, which are guidelines from an acquiring bank, that there can be more than one ATM operator per terminal. That's important because you could take an example of an ATM at a corner store here in DC. If the merchant owns that ATM, it can be the ATM operator. If there's a sales entity that deployed the ATM to the owner, it can be the ATM operator. If there's an entity that provides actual processing services, it can be an ATM operator. Sometimes those entities receive the net interchange or share in it. Other times they don't. But whether they receive net interchange or paid acquire fee, which is the injury they say exists, is irrelevant.
Where do we know that sometimes they receive net interchange and sometimes they don't?
Your Honor, we know that, and I apologize, I'm throwing a lot of cites at the court, but it's important because this is exactly what Judge Leon didn't do, which is scrutinize the evidence in the record of uninjured class members. So we know from JA6108, and that's a class member in this case that's talking about merchants who own and load, have own and load arrangements. And it makes clear that sometimes they do pay acquirer fees indirectly, these merchants, and other times they don't. He set out for the merchants that he deals with, it's 30% versus 70%.
My question was, yeah, I thought you had asserted that sometimes they receive net interchange and sometimes they don't. And now you're talking about whether they pay acquirer fees.
Right. I mean, it's they receive net interchange from which the acquirer fees are deducted. And I, as I understand it, that's the plaintiff's, ultimately what the plaintiffs say. What we're saying to you, Your Honors, is that there are ATM operators that do not receive net interchange at all.
So there's that testimony. Is there anything else?
Yes, there's testimony at 5460 and 5461, which is another example of merchants in these own and load circumstances that sometimes. So the question was in that circumstance, in most they load arrangements, the customer does not receive any interchange, and the answer is correct. And then there's another question, do any customers with they own, they load arrangement to pay network fees? And this is for this.
Customers here, meaning independent.
Meaning ATM operator, meaning a class member, as they have defined class, which is the same as the definition of the Visa rule. Let me just, if I may.
Well, I want to ask you a question, and I asked Visa counsel a question, but I need to be clear that you take the same position. If this court were to hold that the district court, in applying a colorable standard based on the vitamins decision in the district court, that was a clear error of law, given that this court and the Supreme Court have rejected that standard in determining the burden that the plaintiffs face. So hypothetically, just suppose we say that and we remand the case to the district court. And the plaintiffs say, well, in light of the remand, in light of this post-vitamins authority, we want to concede the point that, or with the district court to find that, you know, we agree with the defendant's experts and what the record shows. But it doesn't show that there are no consumers or no operators who had to pay these fees. And that's what I need to be clear about. Why wouldn't on remand the district court be required to do the type of meticulous record review where you're citing all these pages in the joint appendix and make conclusions? And suppose where the class as originally proposed, you know, involved millions. When the district court looks at the record closely and sees what's there, and that his colorable standard is no longer the standard that applies to models, he determines, well, under this more rigorous standard, I agree that the plaintiffs haven't met their burden as to some of the members of the defined class. And then the plaintiffs say, fine, we want to redefine the class in light of this new standard. And when I heard Visa counsel tell me, well, this case is 10 years old, it's just too late to give them another chance. Is that your position too?
Your Honor, it is my position, and there is a particular reason with respect to the ATM operators. For them, they cannot narrow their class definition to just refer to entities that pay acquirer fees directly or indirectly. They can't do that because their entire liability and causation theory is that these rules restrain ATM operators, class members, from setting surcharges at different levels based on the ATM network. If the class is limited to entities that paid acquirer fees directly or indirectly, or received net interchange indirectly or directly, it would exclude significant swaths of entities that are actually responsible for setting surcharges at the terminals. And this class needs to have those entities in, they need it for their theory of liability and their theory of causation, which is that these rules affect the ATM operator.
You've just done a beautiful job of articulating what I think Judge Leon found to be a sufficiently general theory of liability. If it's accepted, then although it may show up in the wash in different places for different independent ATM operators, if the plaintiff's theory is accepted, they are all harmed. They may, you know, receive it in different ways, in different fractions, but it's out there in the market. This non-competitive price that imposes opportunity costs on businesses that would offer a cheaper service if they could. Why isn't that classic predominance?
Your Honor, that is exactly the issue that requires individualized inquiry, because we take a single ATM and we look at the entity that's responsible for setting the surcharges. We look at the entity, there may be a different entity that's getting the acquire fee. If there are different entities, if there are different reasons for changing surcharges, for example, at a casino where they just want to jack up surcharges and there's a different entity that's receiving the economics from the network, then it really does boil down to an individualized inquiry and the common evidence they have of injury, which is of the payment of acquirer fees, cannot be applied to the class as a whole, because we know there are uninjured class members.
I don't follow that. If just because I'm willing to, you know, take this as a loss leader because I want to bring people into my casino, it doesn't mean that it's not a piece of my financial equation that could be different but for an anti-competitive rule.
What they need is common evidence to establish injury. And they have defined, they say, all class members, as they've defined it, are injured by the payment of an inflated acquirer fee. And we know, based on this class definition, that there are entities that don't pay that acquirer fee at all. And so, therefore, this common evidence they have can't be used for all of their
class members.
What's
your best example of the ones that don't pay? Like, can you explain in a way, if you're trying to make this theory make sense, not just, you know, throwing up things that aren't explained. Can you affirmatively explain why it would be that there would be entities that don't pay acquirer fees?
I appreciate that, Your Honor. And I've cited a few examples from the record. You can think of, again, let's go back to our corner store. The ATM is rolled in to the corner store. The merchant has the discretion, the corner store itself, as an ATM operator, has discretion to set interchange at to set the surcharges at whatever level it wants. In this situation, just bear with me. Well, that's in the record. There are examples of merchants that have the ability to set surcharges. They have the discretion there. They are ATM operators. They're also merchants. They have their own discretion
to set them below Visas and MasterCard.
To set them at the level they want, consistent with the rules at issue. So they can surcharge everybody $5. They can surcharge everybody $10 for taking out cash.
How about $2? How about $1?
Yes, they can. We're not talking about the operation of the rule. We're talking about here that there's a distinction, Your Honor, between the operation of the rule with respect to the entities that it restrains on the one hand, and the entities who these plaintiffs are claiming are harmed, which are the ATM operators that are actually paying the acquirer fee indirectly. They don't have to be the same. That's part of the problem here. And the record sites we provided, I think, illustrate that. I see I'm way over time. I will just emphasize that in Rail Freight 2, this court has made clear that it's improper to defer questions about the number and nature of individualized inquiries that might be necessary to establish liability. That's exactly what happened below.
And do you have a standard that you think we should adopt other than hard look, rigorous?
All I have, Your Honor, is the language from Rail Freight 2. And I believe that language ought to apply here. I just read it. And I do. I agree with my colleague, Justin Anderson, on that issue.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Your Honors.
And I think you're not seeking any rebuttal, but Mr. Anderson is.
Thank you.
All right, and I believe we hear next from Mr. Rubin.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm Jonathan Rubin with Mogan Rubin LLP on behalf of the ATM operator plaintiffs. My comments today will be addressed solely to the case brought by the ATM operator plaintiffs. I believe the issues involved with the operators are substantially different, as is the nature of the class and the nature of the claim. So restricting our attention to the ATM operator plaintiffs, I think it's clear, it's been said before, that the standard of review is abuse of discretion or clear legal error. This is a very deferential standard. And we don't believe that, and in addition, the DC Circuit case law calls out in several cases that it's the district court that is uniquely well situated. We don't believe the defendants have met the standards and have established that there is any abuse of discretion or any legal error. There is no indication in the briefs or elsewhere that the court failed to consider anything. Either the defendant...
Mr. Rubin, is it always true that the acquiring bank remits net interchange to the ATM operator?
Thank you for the question, Your Honor. There's a great deal of confusion, some of which was just presented to this court. There are certain layers that are exist in the industry that exist because the networks do not permit non-financial institutions to be members. Accordingly, there is the network at the top layer. There is a layer of financial institutions there under. And financial institutions, there are non-financial institutions.
One of the basic pieces of advice that I give to people arguing is if when somebody asks you a question, I can't even absorb what you're saying unless you tell me before you get going into the details, yes or no. Is it always true that the acquiring bank remits net interchange to an independent ATM operator?
Your Honor, the word remit suggests that there is a payment from the acquiring bank to the network. We do not believe the acquiring bank touches any of the money. The acquiring bank is lending their credentials as a member of the network to the ISO, which, and the acquiring bank is not the correct term here. It's incorrectly stated in appellant's brief. The correct term is sponsoring bank. There are four or five sponsoring banks that sponsor independent ATMs. We have testimony in the record from the processors who specialize in processing ATM transactions that the acquiring banks, the sponsoring banks do not touch the money. The money is paid by the processors who are in the layer between the networks and the functional entities. What happens is that Mr. Eisenstein...
Do the ATM operators get that?
What happens is the ATM operators on a per transaction basis are entitled to a payment of interchange. Sometimes it's called reverse interchange because it's different from the point of sale interchange. But that is an additional revenue stream on a per transaction basis that is paid by the issuing bank to the ATM operator through the processor.
You're saying the ATM operators do get this. They get interchange on every transaction,
and that interchange, when the processor passes it to the ATM operator, they deduct the network fee and send it to the network in a mass for all of their ATM operator customers.
And is there a place in the record you would point me to for that?
I would point you to I don't have the pin site for it, but it's the testimony of Paul Willingham, who is a functionary with Switch Commerce, which is a processor that specializes in ATM processing. I think a crucial point I need to make at this point, however, is that every ATM operator is entitled to receive interchange. It gets the interchange. And what it does with it is what Mr. Eisenstein was talking about. Downstream from the ATM operator are other parties, in particular, the location owner. The location owner is the customer of the ATM operator. There are arrangements that the ATM operator says, as part of payment of rent, we will give you a portion or all of our interchange revenue. Mr. Eisenstein has told this court that because of that, the ATM operator does not pay acquiring fees. This is plainly ridiculous. It is as if I were to say that because my employer deducts my taxes from my paycheck and pays me a net salary, I don't pay taxes. My employer pays the tax. It is clear from the report of Dr. McAndrews, who was a research head of research for the New York Fed for 6 years, that the economic incidence of ATM acquirer fees falls on the ATM operator, regardless of what they do downstream with their customers. Whether or not they give their interchange away does not affect whether they have suffered the incidence of the acquirer fee. I urge the court to take a look at the announcement in 2005 where Visa introduced the term ATM operator. the class definition is not a wholesale adoption of Visa's terminology, but we have taken their approach to defining ATM operator as the entity in the environment that does certain things. One of the things they do is give the instructions to the processor regarding the level of the surcharge, who is to receive the interchange, who is to receive the surcharge, to handle the encryption keys, and to otherwise operate the ATM. I direct the court to JA6897, where one of the founders of the processor, Switch Commerce, explains what it is that an ATM operator does that no other party can do, which means encryption keys, communicating regarding the level of the surcharge and who gets the interchange. These are things that a merchant cannot do. In 2005, when Visa defined an ATM operator, they put a footnote in their rules, and it said quite clearly that that premises owners are not ATM operators. Even if the merchant loads the cash into the machine, they are not an ATM operator. Even if they receive interchange, they're not the ATM operator. They are never permitted to change the surcharge or direct the distribution of funds that is, or handle encryption keys. Those are the roles of only the ATM operator. Finally, I understand my time is short, but I need to make this point, and that is that if in fact there was variation in who pays the acquirer fee, where is the evidence of that? Where is the memo that says, oh, in this particular case, somebody else will pay the acquirer fee? Or the network letter that says, oh, we didn't get the acquirer fee from whoever you are supposed to pay it. The reason there is no evidence of this is because there is a custom and practice in this industry that has been around for almost 30 years, and that is that the deployer of the ATM is responsible for the acquirer fee. That is why, without a shadow of a doubt, and after a rigorous analysis, which, by the way, was the standard since 1982, with a Supreme Court case by the name of Falcon, I think General Telephone versus Falcon, that's where rigorous analysis comes. Judge Leon is fully familiar with this standard. There is really zero evidence on the part of the defendants that shows that there is anything other than the practice and custom that the ATM operator deployer pays every penny of the acquire fee, and we stand strongly by our contention that every ATM operator member of the class pays the acquire fee.
Judge Rogers, did you have any further questions from Mr. Rubin? All right. Thank you, Mr. Rubin. I think we'll hear next from Mr. Cooper.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, David Cooper on behalf of the Mackman class. The defendants make only one very narrow argument against certification of the Mackman class. They say that all the evidence of class-wide entry does not suffice because our expert used Wells Fargo data in his entry model, and that data is supposedly not representative of the class. But in looking at this issue, it's crucial to note that no one uses complete data for all the transactions because that data doesn't exist. So the experts had a choice. Do you use the complete data for one bank, Wells Fargo, or do you use incomplete data for the other banks, limited to transactions over one particular network? Each expert explained why they made their choice, why our expert chose to do the complete data for one, why their expert chose to do incomplete data for the others. And the question here is whether the district court and this court should resolve this choice of data battle of the experts on class certification.
Let me just tell you one more.
Yes.
My review of the record and thinking about what the district court did and what the two of both sides are arguing is, and I can't pinpoint it precisely. One problem that leaps out for me is it does not appear to be common evidence that sustains class-wide injuries, and that there are a number of persons in the class or classes. for whom there is no indication that there is injury. It just seemed fairly straightforward to me. And I don't know how, in light of the existing law, that can stand.
So there is...
You're not doubting that they... Because my understanding was that your argument was, well, we can whittle away, we can work that out later. And I thought the district court was saying, you can work that out later. But there isn't any doubt under the models that are being pressed. There wasn't any doubt in my mind. In the models that are being pressed, there are any a number, large numbers of members in the alleged classes that are not injured. There's nothing to indicate injury.
So, no, our position is not that you should be whittling those out. Our position is that there are no uninjured class members.
Every single member in all of the stated classes has been shown to be injured.
In the MACMA class, we're not representing anything with respect. I'm not representing anything with respect to the other classes. I'm saying in the MACMA class, there are no uninjured class members. And there are two competing models. One, which shows that net interchange increases surcharges. Their model shows that for some limited number of banks, there's a, you know, the statistics are inadequate to make a determination. But the point is that their model uses incomplete data. Our expert explained that if this court looks at nothing else in this very large joint appendix, we'd ask this court to look very closely at the section beginning at JA8366. Our expert explains in great detail why their model, using limiting only to the transactions over the Visa network, is the wrong way to look at this, and that there are no uninjured class members because this idea that they exist only happens because you're looking at a very limited data set, looking at only a particular kind of transaction. So the question is, what do you do when you have competing models? They try to shoehorn it into rail freight by saying it's undisputed. It's undisputed. It is disputed. Our model does not show uninjured class members. Their model supposedly shows uninjured class members. And the question is, whose data and whose methodology is correct? That's a classic Daubert question. And they could have raised that in a Daubert motion. They chose not to.
But why aren't they saying, yeah, your data is... At least our data shows your data not to be representative because right. We look at these Visa transactions and what your expert is asserting with respect to the Wells Fargo data appears not to hold with respect to non-Wells Fargo transactions, i.e. these Visa transactions. And your response to that is?
Our response to that is when you look at only the Visa transaction, it distorts the entire model. In other words, you don't get a true answer for Visa transactions. You just get a very, you know, questionable answer for all transactions. And the reason why, if this court looks at the charts on pages JA8377 and 8379, it sort of explains why, which is that the net interchange for the different networks moved at different times. And the mix of what networks bank ATMs were using changed at different times. And as a result, if you're only looking at transactions over the Visa network, you're distorting the entire model because you're looking at how surcharges changed generally, but you're also looking at how net interchange changed only for one network, which isn't necessarily representative of the mix of networks and the mix of net interchange fees that the banks received and the banks presumably would be reacting to in raising surcharges. And I think it's also important to note that it's simply false when they say that there are banks that didn't raise surcharges at all during the class period. And I'd call this court's attention to JA8398-99, where they say 13 banks didn't raise surcharges. That's because they start in 2010. Our class starts in 2007. And to be clear, we say that the NDRs affected net interchange long before that. And so the prices were, the surcharges were high even at the start of the class period.
So Citibank set it high earlier, is your view. Do I have the facts right? Citibank?
Yes.
You're saying at that they set it high, they didn't have to raise it in response, but isn't that inconsistent with your theory, which is that it's in response to diminution of net interchange that the surcharges are raised?
So, yeah, it's not inconsistent because net interchange did go down even before the class period, in fact, substantially before the class period. So when they raised surcharges in 2007 to 2008, that was in response to a reduction of net interchange. So these things happen at different points in time, and it's important to keep that in mind. I think the other important point to keep in mind is that even with their model, if you apply it to, you know, the entire class period, 95 out of the 100 banks show this, of the top 100 banks, show this relationship between net interchange and surcharge. And so For those, there's essentially no dispute that we have common evidence of class-wide injury. And so the question is, what about those other five? And what our argument is simply that if you're trying to extrapolate, because we don't have complete data for those other five, if you're trying to figure out, based on the data we have, does it make more sense to extrapolate from Wells Fargo and from those 95, or to think that five banks would be such outliers that in response to a lower net interchange, and in response to the other 95 banks keeping surcharges low because they were getting more net interchange in this but-for world without the anti-competitive conduct, those five banks would do nothing. They would keep their surcharges extremely high and be completely anti-competitive. And our expert explained why in this market that makes absolutely no sense at all. And while this court, obviously, we're not asking it to decide who's making more sense, the question is, I see my time's up, but if I continue.
Yeah.
The question is, what are you deciding? Because it can't be that the decision is whose expert is right and whose expert is wrong. That can't be the question on class certification. And I know that, you know, the defendant's counsel says we'll take a hard look. But the question is, a hard look at what? So you've taken your hard look and what are you deciding?
You're taking a hard look at the evidence that's being offered to determine whether most of the members of the class are injured.
So I don't
isn't
think...
Isn't that what we're supposed to be doing? Is that what the district court judge is supposed to be doing? Are you stating a theory where what you're suggesting as the model for weighing the evidence would exclude a number of the class members? That's not good. That would fail the hard look test, right?
No, respectfully, we're not saying that you should. We're saying that what you should look at is whether the questions can be answered on a class-wide basis, not whether or not our the questions will be answered in our favor. That's what Amgen says. So the question is not whether we did prove that in fact all.
Well, but if the other side says, and I'm not saying anything about this case, the other side says 20%, 30% of the people in their proposed class, under their model, cannot possibly be shown to be injured. That fails hard look, doesn't it?
Well, if it's cannot possibly, that's rail freight one. Yes, cannot possibly. Right. But we're clearly not within.
If they say cannot possibly?
No. So rail freight one says detects injury where none could exist. In other words, if not whether they say or we say, but whether in fact, if injury could not exist, yes, we agree that would fail. Or in rail freight two, if they're saying our own model shows that they're uninjured class members and there is, quote, no common proof, that would fail too. But when you have a dispute between the experts and the totality of the evidence on both sides of whether there are uninjured class members, the question is, and Tyson explains this very well, is that can that dispute itself be resolved on a class-wide basis? And that's why Tyson said a dispute over whether data is sufficiently representative is one that can be decided on a class-wide basis and therefore does not preclude class certification. So you're certainly taking a hard look, you're taking a rigorous analysis of what the evidence is and whether or not the trial, if it goes forward, could be done on a class-wide basis. What you're not doing is deciding who's right or wrong and effectively just sort of taking the merits away from the jury just because it's a class-wide case. And if I could just close by saying one thing in response to Judge Rogers' question about remand.
Could I just ask you, you're reading Tyson's to say what?
Sure. So I think there are two critical pieces of language in Tyson. The first is that, quote, statistically inadequate, whether data statistically inadequate or based on implausible assumptions did not raise a challenge to the, is insufficient. If they don't raise a challenge on Daubert to statistical inadequacy, then that's not a class-wide issue. And then the second piece of language, and the court explains why, is that because whether or not it was unrepresentative or inaccurate is itself common to the claims made by all class members. So that's ultimately the question. Can we decide this class-wide? Not who's right about it, but can we decide class-wide? And here we clearly can. They're not producing a ton of individual evidence that would force us to not resolve this in a class-wide matter. And we're here with class-wide evidence talking about whose expert is right. And so that can be done on Daubert, that can be done on summary judgment, but it should not be done on class certification, and certainly not under a standard where you're saying just, okay, we're going to pick which expert chose the right data. Because this is not a case where our expert has admitted at all, where our model admits at all that they're uninjured class members. It's where their model, using incomplete data, chose for a small subset that is we can't tell because the data is so inadequate that we can't reach a statistical conclusion.
So if at a later time, and I'm not sure when it would be, the district judge looks further, hears from these experts, you know, at trial, I guess, and Visa and MasterCard move have the class decertified and the judge says, look, I'm crediting their data, not yours, the district judge could decertify the class. What happened if he credited their approach?
Well,
might have an appellate issue, but he would have to decertify the class?
If it were on a summary, if, for example, on summary, I mean, the question is at what stage is the judge doing that, right? But if it were, for example, Daubert, let's say they made a Daubert motion, even though they could have made it before, but let's say hypothetically they could raise one later, they make it, or the judge says, no, this is unreliable, I have to throw it out. Yes, the judge could decertify the class, and Rule 23 accounts for that. Rule 23 says the trial judge does have a continuing obligation to look at the class and to see whether or not the class should remain certified. So we have no problem with the district judge having the authority and the discretion to look at this going forward. The only problem we have is with this court, or even on remand, the district court deciding at this stage of the proceedings which expert is right and which expert is wrong under some nebulous standard of hard look, but we're not going to say sort of what the actual reliability or plausibility standard is.
So the district judge is supposed to find predominance, but not make fact findings about which expert to credit?
Yes, I think that's correct. I think that the question is, if you look at the expert reports, can the issues, the dispute between the experts and more generally whether or not, you know, all class members were injured, be decided on a class-wide basis? If the nature of the reports is such that it cannot be decided on a class-wide basis, then you would fail predominance.
And what's your short answer to why the Wells Fargo data is representative?
Sure. So I think there are a couple of points in that. First, it is the complete data. There's no dispute that that is, in fact, the best data to use because it includes all the transactions. So that's why we use it. Now, why is Wells Fargo representative? Our expert explained in great detail why. It's about the nature of this market, which is that it's a commoditized product, ATMs, an extremely competitive market in terms of the surcharges. And if you look at the market historically and do an empirical analysis of it, that's the banks do move together. That is to say, you don't have these outliers where a bank just chooses to be completely non-competitive. So Wells Fargo is one of the largest banks in the country. It exhibited this relationship. Even using their own incomplete data, 95 out of 100 exhibited this relationship. It is more than a reasonable conclusion from all of that and from their, frankly, a ton of documentary evidence showing that this is in fact actually what happened. It's a far more than reasonable conclusion to say that, yes, there is this relationship and this relationship exists for all of the banks. And so that's what our experts said. And the district court is well within its discretion in accepting that conclusion.
Right. Questions from my colleagues?
No.
Right. And we will now hear, thank you, Mr. Cooper. We'll now hear from Mr. Is it Lovell or Lovell?
Lovell.
Lovell for the Burke plaintiffs.
I'd like to start to try to address Judge Edwards' questions. First, this legal standard for antitrust injury is whether the prices paid in the actual world are higher than what the prices would have been in the but-for world, so that prices can go down in the actual world, in the conspiratorial environment, prices can go down. In footnote 2 of our brief, we cite the Lodron, LCD, lots of cases which haven't been contested, that in high-tech cases, in Ray ebooks, et cetera, real world prices go down, but those prices are higher than they would have been in the absence of the conspiracy. So the trick is to look at the but-for world for the antitrust injury. Now, so their whole standard, this thing, is a false construct. Prices had to go up during the conspiracy period. Let's address the differences between this case, you have to go to the facts to some extent. The differences between this case and Rail Freight 2. In this case, the price fixing rules existed for every transaction, every day, every year for 30 years from the mid 1990s until today. And there was no chance for a competitive market to develop. In Rail Freight, there was a before period where there was no conspiracy. There was a during period where an alleged conspiracy to fix the fuel surcharge started up. The plaintiff's model, using the before period for a clean period, did a regression, and they came in and they showed that 12.7% of the people had a gain. had negative damages. And that was it. That, I mean, there's a lot of, Rail Freight 2 has a lot of interesting comments in it. But what it comes down to is that the Judge Friedman was within his discretion to find that 12.7% is way too much and it's uncontested. And there's no way to get around your own model, what it shows. Here, and here there is no before period. We can't run a regression. We're being held to a false standard from a different case where they could have a before period and do a regression. In our case, all the transactions have been conducted in a conspiratorial environment, and you can't do a proper regression in that environment. And then now turn to the admissions that were before Judge Leon by defendant's expert, Dr. Hubbard. He admitted that his study that purported to show that a small minority of the ATMs did not raise their surcharges, small minority, it was 99% of the transactions were subject to raise surcharges in Dr. Lehr's rerun. It was 96% of the transactions in Dr. Hubbard's own, the defendant's expert's own run. In putting that in, he said at his deposition, he was very fastidious. I am not saying that there's no relationship. I'm not saying that there's not the negative relationship. I'm only saying that the plaintiffs have not demonstrated. Well, Dr. Hubbard, have you given a good analysis? No, it pains me to say that my analysis is not a good analysis. We quote this in our, it's JA 7433-34 and 7458. Dr. Hubbard said he doesn't have a good analysis. Well, why do you have the analysis? It's really plaintiff's analysis, he said. I'm taking what plaintiffs would have done. And so then Dr. Lehr, the economist for the Burke plaintiffs, comes back in rebuttal and points out the data that Dr. Hubbard selected was not at the ATM level. Dr. Lehr, in the rebuttal, ran regressions at the ATM level and had statistically significant one-to-one relationship results. Dr. Lehr points out that what Dr. Hubbard did was to take what's called ISOs, which are ATMs are coming in and coming out, coming in and coming out, month by month. The thing is changing. So then, while it's changing, Dr. Hubbard is averaging within these periods. And as the periods go forward, he still finds that 92% of the ATMs, which have 96% of the transactions, had the prices go up. Not the legal standard, it's just whether it's higher in a conspiracy. But he finds that, and Dr. Lehr finds it's 99% with it. And Dr. Lehr's rebuttal says his analysis was doomed to fail. It was doomed to fail because he only looks up one level above the ATM. There's all these mixes going on. He didn't say it's a miracle that it worked out in our favor, but it does reaffirm the industry-wide tax principle.
So we're not deciding this issue in the first instance. What do we do with the fact that there is language in the district court opinion referring to colorable method, referring to a critique of Professor, I know this is not your client, but referring to a critique of Professor Carlton's reliance only on Wells Fargo data as better suited for adjudication of plaintiff's injury and damage on the merits? What do we do with what seem to be, you know, references to colorable method rather than, for example, a common method? How can we affirm if those are not legally correct?
What constitutes a hard look depends upon the disputes before the court. There's many other distinctions between Rail Freight and Comcast, as Your Honor mentioned, with the mismatch between the claims and what was shown. And Rail Freight 1, which had the legacy contracts that couldn't have been subject to price fixing because they were made beforehand in the class. So we don't have any of that here. So what constitutes a hard look in this situation? I submit, Your Honors have to look at the decision compared to the record, and there is a finding as your honors pointed out, Judge Pillard, right at the beginning, it satisfies the standard. And there are infelicitous words that show up in a detailed analysis of going through what the judge thinks about three complicated cases. And this, so the law evolves, Rail Freight 2 happened. Now we're going on to a totally different fact situation where the judge did not use the exact right words, 2 points or 3 points in the opinion. So that's where the law is. And what are we going to do? Your honors know better than I, but I'll give Judge Marrero has a law review article in the Cardozo Law Review. He's a district court judge in New York about how long it takes to do a complicated case nowadays. If the judge does not get rid of a complicated case in the district courts in New York, the judge is signing on for all these big, thick papers over and over. And the search for any problem with every ruling is intense because of the amount of money. And in my practice, which is class actions, I see that papers are put in where it seems to me the strategy of the defense is to provoke us to put in a long paper to rebut it. And it all adds to the district court's work. So maybe you could take that fact into consideration as a policy issue of what's going on in the courts.
Well, the problem, of course, is that district courts may have to work harder, but they've also got to comply with the standards that are applicable at the time they're deciding the case. And I think you make some nice arguments. And the question I keep thinking about in my mind is what counsel seem to be asking the appellate court here to do is to go through this very detailed analysis that you cannot find in the district court's opinion other than some sort of conclusory sentences with some examples, and giving the benefit to the district court, we try to read his opinion consonant with the correct law. And I guess at some point when the district court cites the standard in vitamins and the law has just moved on since then, that is very troubling. If on remand the district court were to reference the correct standard, it is not inconceivable to me that some of the analysis you and other counsel have suggested to this court today and in your briefs could still decide, having taken a hard look, to certify the class. And I know nobody wants to stretch this out further. Nobody wants to multiply the district court's burden. But I have seen appellate courts write opinions that say, well, the district court didn't say beyond a reasonable doubt, but he said it was pretty clear the defendant was pretty guilty. You know, it's not good enough. Now, this isn't a criminal case, I understand. But there's a whole industry involved and major statutory provisions. So I guess that's where I'm troubled here. And I think a lot of the questions that Judge Pillard raised, you know, make some excellent points, that Judge Edwards raised, make some excellent points. And then sort of what do we do now? And, you know, reading another judge's analysis about it's gotten very burdensome to be a district court judge these days because of the complexity of the cases. Well, try being on the Court of Appeals too. I don't think that helps us much, but that doesn't mean I don't think other parts of your argument have been, and of counsel, other counsel's arguments have been very helpful.
Well, Judge Rogers, I don't mean to shift the burden to this court. And I know that the more that the district court does, the better for this court. And the question is how to get there. In this case, how to decide this case and get to where you want to get. And you wouldn't want to, if you knew enough about the record without burdening yourself too much, you wouldn't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. If the facts here are strongly in favor of the plaintiffs, it's just under the antitrust injury standard of paying higher amounts in the actual world than the but-for world when there's been a price-fixing rule for 30 years, and where there is winnowing. Each one of these terminals has a number in the code. The winnowing, which is recognized by Rail Freight 2 as a way out of even the de minimis, but there is no de minimis. Dr. Hubbard does not offer the opinion there's a de minimis. Dr. Hubbard projects what he did as the plaintiff's work. It's not. But getting back to the main point, how to get there does not require, in this case, vacating or reversing. It requires, if your honors reach the state of mind that I'm arguing for, it requires a saying that you can't do this and you can't do this in the future, but the hard look that the judge took and the record, we're satisfied that in this case, there is not a class certification issue that doesn't have winnowing, that there's an error. There's an error in a couple of words. There's some dated words in the opinion for the reasoning, but when you apply the non-erroneous words, which are unqualifiedly correct resolutions of a very clear record, unlike the concessions in Rail Freight 2, Rail Freight 1, Comcast. But the expert in Comcast said, no, my model doesn't satisfy the only claim that happened. Now that the law's moved on, you're in this new fact situation. You don't have to, in my humble opinion, you don't have to reverse or vacate in order to fully do and give instructions to the district courts. I think I've gone over my time here.
All right. Yeah. Well, everybody did. And it's helpful to have your answers to our questions. We appreciate the guidance. I think we have, thank you, Mr. Lovell. We have a rebuttal from Mr. Anderson. For the appellant. And Mr. Anderson did not have remaining time. He had requested
5 minutes.
We'll give you 3.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to begin with addressing the question of what should the court do? We propose that in light of what we consider to be the clarity of the evidence, there is uninjured class members in each class, and applying the appropriate legal standard, there's really nothing more for the district court to do. And in the interest of judicial economy, this court can simply reverse. It is certainly within the court's discretion. It concludes that the record is not as clear as MasterCard and Visa have presented, to vacate and remand to the district court or Judge Leon to do in the first instance what Rail Freight requires, which is to take a hard look at whether the classes presented models that can show common evidence establishes class-wide injury. As to the arguments that we've heard from plaintiff's counsel for why this court should not vacate, they were all presented in either Rail Freight 1 or Rail Freight 2. For example, I just heard Mr. Lovell argue that he can't be held to show class-wide injury with common proof because it's complicated, and our expert didn't come forward and disprove his theory. And both the Burr class and the independent operator class argue that absence of evidence doesn't indicate evidence of absence, shifting their burden to prove predominance to the defendants to disprove it. That was addressed in the first Rail Freight decision quite clearly, where this court said you can't shift the burden to defendants to disprove that common evidence can support injury. You need to come forward with common evidence showing class-wide injury. This is also not a battle of the experts, as the lawyer for Macklin was arguing. I did not, when I presented earlier, I did not argue what Dr. Hubbard showed. I described their model. Their model is a one-to-one relationship between decreases in net interchange and increases in surcharge. That's their theory, not Dr. Hubbard's theory. We then looked at data to see whether it is in fact the case that when net interchange goes down, surcharges go up. Dr. Hubbard found 15 banks where it didn't, and 13 where it didn't increase at all during the relevant time period, which was 2015. Who chose that time period? Professor Carlson. their expert. We use that time period because that's what their expert determined was appropriate based on, and I'll refer the court to Joint Appendix 3082, the fact that in 2010, there was a significant reduction in net interchange. That's why all of these cases were filed in 2011. And that's why the only question that is relevant here is what happened after that industry-wide reduction?
Well, they say something different. They say that there was a drop also in, I think it was 2006, 2007. Don't quote me if I conflict with what's in the record on that, but and that there was another raise in access fees earlier. So, and that the limitation to 2010 worked with the data they were using, but was distorting with the data that your expert was using. So, you know, without resolving that, those all are, according to the district court, issues that don't break the sort of general wholesale nature, yay or nay, of the issues presented down the road.
I understand, but they had an obligation to come forward with a model of injury. In Ralph Craig 2, the court said that in antitrust actions, common questions can't predominate. They can't predominate without reliable means of proving class-wide injury. They had to come forward with a model.
But that is something that Judge Leon held. He said they have standard and reliable means of showing class-wide injury.
You're right.
He didn't go in as much chapter and verse to explaining why that wasn't taken down by your counter evidence, but he did. He did make that determination.
His words. But he didn't do the work, Your Honor. He was supposed to take a hard look at the evidence we presented, grapple with, explain. He didn't just, and Judge Rogers mentioned that he announced the wrong standard in his decision. He didn't just announce the wrong standard, he applied the wrong standard. Every single paragraph of the two pages in his decision where he explains why plaintiff's models were sufficient refers to them as either, quote, colorable, reasonable, well-established, well-accepted, colorable, well accepted, colorable. These are words that are not just in the stated standard that isn't correct.
It applies other words that are closer to what I think was the standard he was supposed to apply. And the fact that he didn't write an opinion that was 300 pages long is not critical here, it seems to me.
I agree.
And the question in my mind still is, the legal standard he applied, and you know, some of the statements Judge Pillard was referring to. In addition, there are statements where the district court found that the plaintiffs could rely on reliable data, you know, that sort of thing. So, in any event,
and Your Honor, I think we
understand this argument with all due respect.
With respect to the representative nature of the representatives of the data, if Your Honor, you had asked about whether someone who banked at Citibank could rely on the Wells Fargo data to prove his or her injury. And that's exactly the right question. Under Tyson, you can come forward with representative evidence if any individual in the class could rely on that evidence to prove his or her case at trial. If you are someone who withdrew cash from a Citibank ATM that did not increase or charge, you cannot come into court and say, well, they increased it over there at Wells Fargo.
But that is the underlying factual dispute, whether Citibank did not increase surcharge. And the plaintiffs are saying our evidence showed Citibank to increase surcharge off the end that you were looking at. And I understand that's you know, a dispute that remains pending. But whether it's susceptible of class-wide determination, you haven't made crystal clear to me why not.
Because how would you, based on the model?
I won't keep you, why don't you wrap up and we'll take the case.
Based on the models that the plaintiffs put forward, what is the winnowing mechanism? How is the district court supposed to remove the class members who withdrew cash only from Citibank and all the other ATMs that didn't increase surcharges? No plaintiff has come forward with a model that says, plug this data in, and it's, we'll see which expert is right, but if we're right that they all increase surcharges, it'll be fine. If defendants are right and the jury accepts evidence that some ATMs did not increase surcharges, plug that model in, we can winnow out the uninjured. They have not come forward with that. They reject that they even have the burden of it because they rely on a simplistic theory of injury, which is one-to-one. And they've had 10 years to develop it. They had full access to discovery, and they have the assistance of able counsel and a talented economist. And that was what they submitted. That is insufficient under rail freight. This court should reverse the district court's decision. Thank you.
Thank you so much.